You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 23rd of December 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com, because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from russjournal.org. Good day, Matt. Are you looking forward to Christmas? How are you doing?
Yes, I am. It's, of course, my Christmas is a little different than yours. I have my Christmases when you can get 75% off anything you want, because it's on the 6th, the night of the 6th. I tell you, I'm doing all right. To be honest, I'm sick and tired of talking about Ukraine. You know, when you're a specialist in an area and you get interviewed as much as me, you say the same things over and over and over and over again. So I switched up the topic today in something that really I don't think anyone's talking about.
Yes, you certainly have come up with a topic that I wasn't really expecting, and I suspect I may have a rather different point of view on it to most people. I may end up seeing as if I'm playing a devil's advocate here. We're going to be talking about Israel's new shoot-to-kill policy, which is basically a formalized shoot-to-kill policy, where they were doing this before, but it was unofficial. Israeli military has amended its open fire rules in the occupied West Bank, allowing troops to shoot Palestinian protesters who toss rocks and firebombs at cars and civilians, even if they no longer pose an imminent threat. The policy was introduced around a month ago, but the Israeli Defense Forces has refrained from making a public announcement. A military spokesman only confirmed the changes to the Times of Israel paper on Monday after reports about the open fire rules emerged in the local media. Under the new rules, IDF troops are permitted to go through the entire arrest protocol if they see a Palestinian throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at vehicles, including the use of deadly force against the suspect, even if he doesn't have any objects in his hands. Previously, soldiers were only allowed to fire when arresting the perpetrator while he was still in the act of tossing stones or firebombs. The amendments were needed because the initial rules in many cases allowed the attackers to avoid responsibility for their actions, the spokesman explained. And I think if you look at this and you don't sort of take in what goes on around it, you've basically got one group of people that are throwing rocks and firebombs at another group. They're sort of initiating the confrontation. And then you've got the other group that have had enough of this. The other side have been throwing rocks and firebombs for decades now. So they say, right, well, we're just going to shoot you. And to be honest, I mean, it's their country. And if that's what's going on there and they want to shoot these Palestinians, it's their right to do that. And I think people get upset about it because it looks hypocritical, because the Jews that are outside of Israel are always pushing for human rights and wherever they are. And yet the Jews that are in Israel are like this. They're very nationalist. And that's the difference. The Jews that are in Israel are nationalist Jews. The ones that are outside of Israel, they promote globalism and human rights. So I'm of the mind that this is Israelis in Israel. They can do whatever they like as far as I'm concerned. And I'll probably get a lot of stick for saying that. Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't think we disagree on a lot of this, except that my problems with Zionism are historical, because this ethnic group has no right to be in that area. They're not the descendants of the ancient Israelites. There seems to be no accountability for the military's actions, like you would have, for example, in Russia or Belarus or South Africa years ago, and it's done on the American taxpayer's dime. But on the other hand, this is an ethno state, and any ethnostate would have to go through this same process. So, you know, it's something that we may be able to learn from in the long run. But again, how this group of foreigners was imposed on Palestine, you know, that's what caused all this. So, but again, that was a long time ago. They're there, and we can learn from how they're building this ethnostate. Now, as far as what you read, again, I don't think any other country would be able to get away with this kind of thing. Shooting people who don't pose an imminent physical threat. And of course, you know, this is just a minimum. They've been doing this for a long time. Now that it's been formalized, they've now admitted that they're going to start shooting people. And civilian casualties are tremendous. It's not two armies fighting each other. It's an army fighting a group of civilians. It's a very different situation.
Well, I do get it that there's a power differential there. You've got one group with rocks and petrol bombs, and you've got the other group with heavy artillery. But the group with the rocks and firebombs are still the ones that are firing first. And I guess the Israelis would say, well, how different is that to the British Empire going into Africa and fighting against the Zulus, or the American pioneers fighting against the Red Indians who were barely out of the Stone Age? And the pioneers had muskets and cannon and firepower. And so the Israelis would say, well, you're being hypocrites for criticizing us because you were doing the same 200 years ago. And every country, like in the world, it has to be paid for in the blood of somebody. That's what makes it your country, because your ancestors died and fought wars for that country. And I mean, what you're saying there about the Israelis, they're not the descendants of the ancient Israelites. Well, the Americans today aren't the descendants of the Red Indians. You know, we have limited territory. We fight over it. The group that wins the fight gets the territory. And you know, that may sound harsh, but that's the way that it is. And I know a lot of people criticize Israelis. I'm not so critical of Israelis, but I think what's at the root of it is criticism of Jewish behavior outside of Israel. But I guess that's another subject here. Continuing with these quotes here. However, he clarified that the troops are still urged to make verbal warnings and shoot in the air before actually employing deadly force. An arrest without any shots being fired still remains the preferred outcome for the IDF, the spokesman added. The new rules only apply to attacks on civilians and supposedly do not allow shooting at the Palestinians who toss rocks at Israeli security personnel during protests. The changes introduced by the IDF have already been questioned by legal experts. A former chief military prosecutor, Liron Liebman, told The Times that a person who is fleeing doesn't present a threat, and that deadly force should only be a last resort measure. Eliav Liebelik, a law professor at Tel Aviv University, argues the new rules contradict the international laws of armed conflict, since there is no active conflict in the West Bank, as well as human rights laws, due to not matching the needs of self-defense. So it is uneven. And I guess what they're saying is it's uncivilized to be doing this. But again, they're still calling this a protest. I mean, we were calling protests that saw shops being burnt down and Molotov cocktails last year, we were saying those are riots. And yet what they're saying here is, these are just protests that the Palestinians are engaged in. But if they're throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at civilians, then that's a little bit more than a protest, isn't it? Do you think?
Yeah. But generally speaking, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. And by the way, let me clarify what I meant by not being related to the Israelites. That's their claim, at least the rabbinical claim, is that we belong here, we deserve to be here because we're the same people. And therefore, we have a right to this land. That isn't the case. And that's really what I meant by that. But as far as this is concerned, they're usually protesting the demolition of homes and the killing of civilians. This has been going on for a long time. And the only actually armed force that they've had to deal with is Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and they've given it over to them. That's probably the only organized military force. And Hezbollah, of course, is in Lebanon, which has defeated the IDF in the past. So I'm willing to go to the mat for the rioters only in the sense that what they're protesting is legitimate, and destroying homes, and a lot of these people can't work They can't cross the border into Israel to work. Their economy's been strangled by blockades, like the Gaza Strip has been blockaded. I'm not sure what else these people can do. Pornography has been pumped into their TV system. And they've been living in essentially refugee camps since 1948, and that's how they're raised. So that's the issue here. They don't have the privileges that American blacks do, for example. So and I understand. I mean, you know, they're there now. The Jews are there now. But this is a direct result of their own actions, a direct result of their own violence and arrogance. And again, at the expense of the American taxpayer, because we're paying for all of this. And everything the Israelis do, the Arabs just consider it as Americans doing it. I'll never forget that picture of the demolition of a Palestinian home in an olive grove by a tractor that had a big caterpillar sign on. You know, this is an American firm. They associate this stuff with the U.S. The U.S. probably paid for it all. The settler movement, these guys don't work. They're paid entirely by the American taxpayer. But what you said about Jews outside of Israel is absolutely right. They demand open borders for everybody but Israel. Now, there's a few dissidents, like the Selim movement we'll quote here in a minute. There's a few Jewish dissidents there. They can't handle this anymore. And many of them are saying that it's just not a viable state. Israel's not a viable state anymore because of this constant violence. They can't build the economy that they would like to if they're constantly spending all this money on security.
Well, I think what that really shows is that multiculturalism is a failure. I mean, that's what you have there. You have these two different ethnicities that are within one territory, and this is what it has devolved to. We have another quote here, which is from B.T. Salem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And this is from a few years back, 2017, and it concerns the older open fire policy, the one which has recently been revised. They say, over the years, Israel has killed thousands of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Some were killed by security forces during routine activities to enforce the occupation, such as arrests or crowd control. Others were killed during rounds of fighting, such as those in the Gaza Strip or Operation Defensive Shield in the West Bank. Thousands more have been injured by security forces' fire, some seriously and with lifelong repercussions, including physical or mental disabilities. The open fire policy, which allows unjustified use of lethal force, conveys Israel's deep disregard for the lives of Palestinians and facilitates Israel's continued violent control over millions of Palestinians. Most of the tasks performed by Israeli security forces in the occupied territories are policing activities, which include dispersing demonstrations, making arrests, enforcing travel restrictions, conducting body frisks and home searches, and more. Soldiers performing these tasks must follow the military's open fire regulations, the official goal of which is to regulate and limit the use of firearms. These regulations set the rules for the use of various types of firearm, as well as the permitted ranges and targets. According to the open fire regulations, prior to the recent changes, live ammunition may be fired in two situations only. First, shooting to kill is permitted when members of the security forces or other individuals are in life-threatening danger. Even then, the use of firearms is permitted, only if there is no other way to avert the danger and only against the assailants themselves. Second, members of the security forces may only shoot at a person's legs as the last phase in an attempt to arrest the person in question, only after they have given warning and fired in the air, and only when no one else is in danger of getting hurt. And the bit I'd like to pick up on in that is it's saying that it conveys Israel's deep disregard for the lives of Palestinians. But on the other hand, does it not also convey Israel's deep concern for the lives of Israelis? I mean, they consider an Israeli's life to be worth 1,000 lives of a Palestinian's. I mean, if it comes down to saving an Israeli or killing 1,000 Palestinians, they're going to kill 1,000 Palestinians because they are that ethnocentric, that they are that concerned about their own people. And to be honest, you know, I don't see that as a bad thing, that they consider their own people to be that important. They understand that their nation is their extended family. And we should be the same. We should be that concerned. And we should have this much regard for our own people, because nobody else is going to. So, I mean, obviously they got this regard for the Palestinian lives, but that's the way that it looks, because they have so much concern for Israeli lives, and they don't want rocks and petrol bombs, and they don't want rockets being fired at them. Do you think? What do you think of that one?
Yeah, that would be true in the abstract. In reality, you know, we all know the double standard. These very same people would condemn any ethnostate of ours doing this kind of thing. I'm not saying I wouldn't have minded this kind of policy against the rioters last summer. But the situation is very different. This is in response, I should mention, the Operation Desert for the Defensive Shield, which was a massive incursion in 2002, which expropriated land, it demolished homes in response to a suicide bomber. This is no way to solve the problem. I don't care who they are. But, you know, the ethnocentrism is a matter of Jewish supremacy. It's not something that they'll universalize. They'll condemn the wall that Trump tried to build and yet be surrounded by this massive wall and barbed wire paid for by the American taxpayer. I have no particular, connection with Palestine, or the Zionists for that matter. But they do have a legitimate case to be angry. Their economies have been totally strangled. But now what you just read here is the older version, shoot to kill only when there's an imminent threat. That was disregarded. They were being shot anyway. The military wasn't doing much about it. And so now they just formalize the army's disregard of that kind of thing. I'm not sure what Israel expects from their own behavior.
It does just mean that there's going to be more conflict. I mean, people mocked Trump's solution to this, which was effectively to pay the Palestinians lots of money and set up an economy for them and give them these little camps to live in. And really, I mean, that's really going to be the only solution that there is, because the Israelis aren't going to give up now that they're there. And the Palestinians might as well make use of all that money that was being offered them. Getting back to these quotes here, these regulations meant to prevent unnecessary harm to life and limb have failed to prevent the killing of thousands of Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, partly because they are repeatedly violated, sometimes on the orders of senior ranking officers or with their consent. On the ground, soldiers are sometimes given orders that contradict official directives. Sometimes the regulations are interpreted broadly, such as the artificial expansion of the term life-threatening to include circumstances in which soldiers' lives are not actually in danger, such as stone-throwing or tire-burning during protests, or fear of damage to the separation barrier. Another broad interpretation is permission to fire at the upper body instead of the legs during suspect apprehension, along with expanding the understanding of a person suspected of a serious offence to include virtually any Palestinian. Another violation is the use of lethal measures when less injurious ones could diffuse the threat, and illegal use of allegedly non-lethal measures, such as rubber-coated metal bullets, sponge rounds, and tear gas in a way that renders them lethal. In using firearms in the occupied territories, Israel's actions are also subject to the provisions of international humanitarian law. These allow security forces to open fire even under non-life-threatening situations. However, and most importantly, they restrict the actions of security forces so as to protect civilians who are not taking part in the fighting and their property as much as possible. So it looks like this was all going on anyway, but all they've done is basically formalized this, Matt.
Well, from a practical point of view, sort of like the attacks on the police over the years, in the heat of the moment, I can't imagine these very strict guidelines being followed. And certainly not, from the level of the individual soldier and a squad commander. So it's like, the police have a split second window to decide whether or not they're going to be shot. Anyone would shoot in that situation. It's an impossible situation to be in. If the guy's unarmed, it's his own fault. And that's, I think, similar here, except you have two different circumstances, two different contexts. For example, you have the settler movement that goes into a Palestinian area, just maybe two or three families. The army goes in, surrounds them, and they take their olive groves, they take the orange groves, and that's it. They either burn them down or use it themselves, and displacing God knows how many people. That's what causes a lot of this, and that's what the so-called Land Day protests are. But from the point of view of the IDF soldier policeman, these tight regulations are going to be violated. And, you know, if the police were doing this in the U.S. last summer, there would be condemnations beyond belief. There'd be no policemen left. But here, it's ignored, it's justified, and billions of American taxpayer dollars get poured into have it continue.
You know, I did hear an interview the other day on Professor Edward Dutton's Jolly Heretic program with a Zionist rabbi. Very interesting interview, and he was a settler, and he said the reason why they do this, why they move into these territories, is to secure land so that they have extra land for when the Jews in Europe eventually get pogromed. So they're providing this place there out of a fear that something bad could happen to the Jews in the future, and this is their homeland for them that they are securing. So, you know, that's the way that they see it. Again, it's them trying to do something for their own people, to protect their own people, rather than them wanting to hurt this other group. This other group just happens to be there on that land that they see as their own. Well, under international humanitarian law, the actions of security forces during fighting are governed by two fundamental principles: the principle of distinction and the principle of proportionality. The principle of distinction requires the parties to the conflict to direct their attacks only against persons taking part in the hostilities and against objects that are used for military purposes. To ensure that this distinction is respected, it is forbidden to mount an attack against an object that is not a specific military target, and to use weapons that do not allow sufficiently precise distinction between military and civilian objects. The principle of proportionality prohibits an attack, even where the intended target is a legitimate object of attack, if the damage to the civilian population will be greater than the military advantage anticipated from the attack. Israel claims to follow these rules. However, its open fire policy during fighting, and particularly in massive incursions into Palestinian cities and rounds of fighting in the Gaza Strip, ignores these rules almost entirely. Among other things, soldiers have fired indiscriminately, hitting passers-by. They have used live ammunition and weapons that do not allow sufficient distinction between those participating in the fighting and those not. They have bombed residential buildings with the occupants inside and have destroyed homes and other properties on a massive scale. All of these actions were justified based on a formalistic adherence to IHL provisions and to an expansive interpretation of these rules, to the point where they are drained of all meaning and substance. This conduct, which has caused thousands of casualties, has been largely ignored by the military law enforcement system. In most cases, no investigation is opened at all. In the rare cases that are investigated, no further action is taken. Other than a handful of cases, usually involving low-ranking soldiers, no one has been put on trial for harming Palestinians. Well, what was the example that we actually set these Israelis? What was the example that the white man set these Israelis? Well, we did exactly the same thing in Germany, didn't we? We terror-bombed all these German civilians, and nobody was held to account for that. It was completely disproportionate. And now you've got these Israelis doing the same thing. So does that argument hold up, Matt?
Obviously it's on a different scale. The Israelis have been using white phosphorus in some of its military incursions in the West Bank. They've been using it in form before they gave the Gaza Strip over to Hamas. They've used that, which of course is illegal and a deadly poison gas. They use raw sewage that they spray in homes. Actually, I think we did a show on that a while ago, that method of destroying homes. I don't know how there are any homes left at all with the sheer number, the acres and acres of urban areas that they've demolished or simply given over, like in East Jerusalem, to Jews. And unfortunately, some Greeks were involved in them. Yeah, the terror bombings, of course, on a massive scale, much of which had no connection, whether it be Germany or Japan, to any military object whatsoever. But the double standard here, I can't imagine what would happen if the National Guard in the U.S. did something like this in downtown Chicago with the rioters that frankly had no good reason to riot, who are a privileged group of people in America, certainly because usually upper class or middle class whites doing the riots. If, you know, all other things being equal, this is a far more rational response than the police response in last summer. But things aren't equal, and they do have a claim. They do have a legitimate claim to be violent. With them, not much they can do about it. Yeah, there is no organized military force except in the Gaza Strip. Now, if they were to organize it, you know, if Hamas or Hezbollah were to go into there and take it over, that would be a different. That would be somewhat of a fair fight there. And the IDF has been defeated before in that respect. But this is always going to be ignored because, really, among other things, the whole Talmudic dehumanization of non-Jews. Their rabbis will tell them that this is perfectly okay. On the other hand, what you said before, what the rabbi said, certainly doesn't justify the settler movement. But remember, all of the far-right nationalist groups in Europe in the 19th century believed that Jews should be sent to the Middle East. The Black Hundreds believe that. Groups in the Austrian Empire believe that. And Zionism came into existence under the idea that Jews don't belong in Europe and therefore need to leave it and need to go back to what they consider to be their homeland. That anti-Semitism makes sense, according to Herzl and others, because we're foreigners. And that was the idea in the late 19th century. However, I don't think these groups were expecting the state they were going to form to be financed by them.
Yeah, that's the big difference there. And just another point there as well. I mean, what they were doing is they're investigating themselves. So it shows you that their loyalty to their people is, you know, it's higher than anybody else's loyalty to their own people. And it says here, other than a handful of cases, no one has really been put on trial for this because they're left to investigate it themselves and they're not going to find other Israelis guilty. Moving forward to 2 days ago, and this comes from the same publication, BT Salem. On the 30th of March 2018, Land Day, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip began to hold regular protests along the perimeter fence, demanding an end to the blockade Israel had imposed on the Strip since 2007 and fulfillment of the right of return. The protests, held mostly on Fridays with tens of thousands participating, including children, women and seniors, continued until the end of 2019. Israel was quick to frame the protests as illegitimate. Even before they began, it made various attempts to prevent the demonstrations and declared in advance that it would violently disperse the protesters. The military deployed dozens of snipers along the fence, and various officials clarified that the open fire regulations would permit lethal fire against anyone attempting to approach the fence or damage it. When Gaza residents went ahead with the demonstrations regardless, Israel made good on its threats and its open fire regulations permitted use of live fire against unarmed protesters. As a result, 223 Palestinians, 46 of them under the age of 18, were killed and some 8,000 injured. The vast majority of the persons killed or injured were unarmed and posed no threat to the well-armoured soldiers standing on the other side of the fence. Well, I can tell you straight away what Israel's answer to that would be. They would say, well, look, you've got all these human shields there. That's what those children, women and seniors were doing there. Why were they there when they had been told that this was an illegal protest and it would be broken up by live fire? I mean, we saw, again, what is the example that we actually gave the Israelis? You can go back to India, where there was a protest in India and the British Empire fired on all the protesters. And there's a big fuss made about it today. So they're only following our example, really. What do you think of that one, Matt?
Well, in this case, what Land Day refers to the protests that began 1976 over the policy of so-called the Judaization of Galilee, which was an actual genocide. It was to drive, you know, the whole region of Galilee, including Nazareth, to drive out Palestinians and populate it with Israelis. It failed. It's still maybe 75% Arab right now. But it meant the complete cutting off of water, power, sewage, and of course, the strangulation of the economy. So that's the, and then every year, That was really the first organized protest against the occupation, was in 76. Prior to that, they were too scattered, and Arab governments were not involved, you know, to their detriment. So that's the foundation of this here. And I don't know, maybe you're right, if they're being used as human shields, I have no clue if that's true. You have a lot of young protesters, you know, 16, 17, that's not uncommon. But I can't imagine any other government publicly saying that they're going to shoot unarmed protesters and get away with it. But I'm not seeing any condemnation of Israeli policy on the floor of Congress or the Senate, or their over this kind of thing, and their funding being cut.
That's the point, isn't it? It's the hypocrisy on our part, more so than really what these Israelis are doing, I think. It's the way we respond to it. Well, Israel responded to international criticism of the casualty toll by saying it would investigate the incidents. Yet today, more than 40 months after the first demonstration, it is clear that the military's investigations in relation to the Gaza protests were never intended to ensure justice for the victims or to deter troops from similar action. These investigations, much like the investigations conducted by the military law enforcement system in other cases in which soldiers have harmed Palestinians, are part of Israel's whitewashing mechanism, and their main purpose remains to silence external criticism so that Israel can continue to implement its policy unchanged. State officials have admitted that one of the reasons for Israel's speedy announcement that investigations would be conducted lies in the proceedings that were and still are being conducted against it in the International Criminal Court in The Hague. One of the guiding principles for the ICC's work is complementarity, meaning the ICC will assert jurisdiction only when the state in question is unwilling or unable to carry out its own investigation. Once a state has investigated the incidents, the ICC will not intervene. However, declaring an investigation is underway is not enough to stave off intervention by the ICC. The investigation must be effective and must look into the responsibility of the higher-ranking officials who devised the policy, and possibly lead to action against them where necessary. Israel's investigations in relation to the Gaza protests do not meet these requirements. They consist entirely of the military investigating its own conduct. They focus exclusively on lower-ranking soldiers, and investigators are given a narrow mandate limited to clarifying whether the regulations have been breached, while completely ignoring the question of their lawfulness and of the open fire policy itself. And again, it reminds me of the Nuremberg trials, the Nuremberg kangaroo court that was all completely one-sided. And that's what you've got here. I mean, these Palestinians should not be entertaining the idea that Israel is going to find itself guilty when it investigates itself for doing this. Of course, the Israelis are going to find themselves innocent. That's why it needs a neutral observer. I mean, you could even say that the Israelis would be wrong to find their own people guilty in this. They should have loyalty to their own people. Do you think the Palestinians do actually have any hope that Israel was actually going to find itself guilty after it investigated itself, Matt?
No, I think they're probably looking to third parties. But because the propaganda machine has stated that, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah are simply terrorist organizations that murder little kids, you know, like they claim the Taliban is, that's not going to happen. They're, you know, despite all the good that those two organizations have done, they're never going to be taken seriously. It's not like the Arab states could or Syria could launch an incursion into the area to liberate it. So a lot of this does therefore come from hopelessness and joblessness, and it's going to get worse. There is no economy here. On the other hand, I'm not really sure where the Jews of the world would go. You know, the Bir Bizdan project in the far east of Russia was, of course, a failure. You have Uganda, you had Madagascar. I'm not sure any of those would have succeeded. And because Israel is becoming a non-viable state, I've been talking about the Jewish plan for the new Khazaria in eastern Ukraine, or, you know, around Odessa, which would be an absolute disaster. I'd rather have them in Israel now than in eastern Ukraine. So I'm not sure, you know, if they would, you know, clear out of an area, where they would go. So this is just an intractable conflict for that reason.
It is. Does seem like there isn't a way out. That's why I was saying, you know, this like offering rewards to the Palestinians to stay in their area and not throw rocks at them. You know, that really does look to me as if that is the only way out from this. Well, finishing off with these quotes here. The investigations were entrusted to the Military Advocate General's Corps, the MAG Corps, with the assistance of a special general staff mechanism introduced after Operation Protective Edge, the FFA mechanism. The mechanism was charged with a limited mission, investigating isolated incidents in which soldiers were suspected of breaching their orders. The investigations focused on low-ranking soldiers on the ground. In these circumstances, even if the system had excelled in its investigative work and performed its mission successfully, the contribution to law enforcement would have been limited. Yet a review of the system's operations shows that it does not strive to meet even this limited goal. The military has only investigated cases in which Palestinians were killed by security forces, despite the large number of injuries, including ones that left victims paralyzed or forced to undergo amputations. A total of more than 13,000 Palestinians were injured in the protests, some 8,000 by live fire, about 2,400 by rubber-coated metal bullets, and almost 3,000 by tear gas canisters that hit them directly. Of the persons wounded, 156 lost limbs. None of these cases were investigated. The investigations that have taken place were not independent, as they were conducted entirely by the military without civilian involvement. Moreover, both the MAG and the FFA mechanism work extremely slowly. According to figures supplied by the IDF spokesperson to BT Salem, as of 25th April 2021, the FFA mechanism had received 234 cases in which Palestinians were killed. This figure includes Palestinians who were killed during the period in which the protests were held, but with no connection to them. The mechanism completed its review in 143 of these cases and transferred them to the MAG Corps. And again, I mean, the Israelis would say, well, we told you not to go to these protests. If you come near to our wall, we're going to repel you from the wall, basically. And that's why there was so much of this live fire, and they're going to say, you knew you were going to get shot, and now you're going to the rest of the world and saying, look how many of us have actually been shot, isn't this terrible? But they were the ones that went there when they were told that's what's going to happen if you go there. So, you know, I just think it is, there's arguments to be made for both sides, and a lot of nationalists don't actually look at it from the Israeli side. We tend to be very subjective, mainly because of the way that we perceive Jews acting outside of Israel and this hypocrisy, but that we see happening in this instance here. So what are your final thoughts on all of this, Matt?
Well, you know, the Palestinian nation exists, and the Arab nation civilization certainly exists. That shows you how the level of hopelessness and anger of these people, that they're willing to be shot. They're willing to offer themselves up almost as martyrs against a system that's treated them worse than any colonial regime has ever treated natives. There's nothing like this, especially over this long period of time. So it just shows you how angry and how hopeless these people are, and that's why they're willing to be shot.
Well, I think you raise a really good point there, that, you know, there's lessons that can be learned from both, you know, the dogged determination of the Palestinian nation to be a nation and the Israeli concern for, you know, just one Israeli's life is considered worth more than thousands of Palestinians. And I think there is even a quote in the Talmud about one Jew's fingernail is worth more than lots of non-Jews. Anyway, thank you very much for listening today. Thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion. Talk Radio for the nationalist community.